So it's about something's about to happen with two.
Well, they took the twin otter. We had a twin otter on skis, flew out 200 miles north, found the Russian ice station, landed, and played a game of volleyball while they were there, and then decided the emergency was over, and got in back on the plane and brought back gifts from the Russians. And so that evening, there was a bottle of vodka on my desk and on the commanding officer's desk. And they were saying, this we found on the ice island, the Russians. Well, then we went out to T3, and T3 was a little bit different.
Wasn't that one T3?
No, that was the Russian station. It was manned.
Oh,
so T3 is right behind it, about 72 degrees north. And at that time, it was hazardous for us to do this because it was going to summertime. We didn't want to go out there in summer.
Right.
So about October, I was on my way out on a trip, and we had sent the Twin Otter out just to see T3, if they could see it, and where it was going. And it was heading up toward Wrangell Island and then north. And the crew decided they had to land. And I decided I'm not going on this trip. This is really dangerous. They're now over in the Soviet or Russian territory. So there was a radio silence for a while. What they did do is they did put a battery into the buoy, which, if we didn't have any other incidents, was okay. It's a good thing. And they raised the several American flags I had given them to do. And that they would be, each one of those would be the last flag to fly on T3. And they brought the flags back. And we then tracked T3 for years. I did this. For the next 2 years, I tracked it right from my office here. And we found that T3 was heading up to the North Pole. And eventually, it went down east of Greenland. Mm-hmm. So it went, T3 was gone. We were on the last voyage of that ice island. And it ended up in pieces. Nobody could track it after that. Down off of, probably in the North Atlantic.
So that was
current.
In the...
1981-82.
Oh, that late.
That's when I was tracking it.
Right.
They made their landing in 79, late 79. So it was a kind of a fond farewell, you might say.
Yeah. A long legacy there on those ice islands.
A very long one, yes. There's an interesting book on called Ice Island that deals with it, and mainly the Aralas Islands.
Right.
It's about time to have something else written now as to the value of them, and they were valuable.
Yeah, I'm sure. A lot of important research done out there. So anything else you want to talk about while you were NARL director?
Well, yes, there were lots of things that went on. We supported a lot of projects. My interest in acoustics really developed there by meeting of Commander Bill Ellison, who was from MIT and started his own company called Cambridge Acoustical Associates. And while we were there, just as he was at the house talking, we were saying, why is it we can't use passive acoustic to look for the presence of bowhead whales? Because at that time, there was tremendous interest on development and effect of bowhead whales. And so we just took some crude equipment that we put together and went out. You can certainly hear them where they're all there. So to sort of make a long story short on that one too, that developed into a proposal to the OCSIP program, and it was funded. And it was called, we called it Project Whales. It was, if I remember, it was somewhere in the order of about $1 million. And we published a big report on Project Whales. And then the acoustics developed from there. After that, the acoustics, the North Slope Borough Department of Wildlife Management, get into the business of using acoustics to count whales.
Right, their census work.
The census work, and that involved Bill Ellison and folks in San Diego, and so that goes on well even to the present day. And so that was another thing that was of interest to me. When I came back to the university, I developed a course in bioacoustics. And I taught my last course on that just before I retired with one of our new faculty members. Her name just escaped me. German. At any rate, I forget at the moment. So that was another connection to that. And as a result of that, I had when I left Barrow, there was a lot of oil development, especially at the coast. They felt that they needed a science advisor to review a lot of these reports. So we set up a science advisory committee, and I chaired it. For quite a few years, and then in recent years, the BLM established what was called the North Slope, NSSI, North Slope
Science
Initiative,
yeah.
And they it was mandated to have a science technical panel, advisory panel, and I was its first chair. So that was a bit of a spin-off from the Barrow days.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me like your time in Barrow had a great influence on you. And
it did.
Connection with the native community.
Absolutely. That if I had gone to Turkey, that would have never happened.
Because, you know, you brought that connection with the native community back to Fairbanks to work with the Native students with math and science.
That's right. You know, I wish I could have. Are there any wishes? Yes, I wish I could have done more in a more organized way with our rural students, not only Barrow, but throughout all of Alaska. That's something that still needs to be done. We still don't have that. The university does a very good job through CRD, and the only person I really knew or had a lot of connection with was Sue McHenry,
mm-hmm.
and she was a tremendous influence on my life as to how I was able to deal effectively with our Native students.
Well, you just said wishes, so that. You think about, are there things you wished you had done differently?
Not really. I think I would have gone into almost anything with a tremendous zeal
mm-hmm.
that I would have taken up. I did like this. This was something, remember in the beginning of my talk, how I even got here.
Right.
In the first place was serendipity.
Right.
And that was good that it happened, but it could have been something else. If it had been Scripps, I may be down in Patagonia right now.
But you feel satisfied with the path you've taken?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you ever think about legacy and what legacy you may have left along the way?
I've never given it any thought.
Or what do you think, where do you think you've made a contribution? Or what's important to you that you've left behind?
Well, I think the love for science of the students that I have, tutored and been involved in, that would be the major thing. And I would hope that some of the research that I have done is valuable. Certainly it's part of a building block. Science is iterative. You know, we see great breakthroughs like the discovery of the Higgs boson, for example. Yes, that's maybe not entirely the work of one person. It's the contributive work of a lot of persons that coalesces maybe at under the time of one person who was able to put it all together. That would be a nice thing to do if you do that, but that's not how the world really works. Most of us are contributing bit by bit, and that's the scientific method.
And you feel like you have contributed in some way?
I think so.
I would think that would be satisfying as a scientist.
It is. It's certainly satisfying. I have no regrets.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. Is there anything else that you want to talk about when you were thinking about coming here today?
I can't think of anything, Karen, at the moment.
Or anything else you want to say? Well, one thing we haven't talked about the university is what hasn't worked. We've talked about how good it's been for your career and the opportunities and the teaching. Was it always roses?
No. No, but then you don't expect it to be. I think anyone who expects to be sailing through with nothing but kudos and money coming out like paper towels is out of their mind. That's not the way life works. I think that it works best if we are able to fix the things that go wrong, and not deliberately try to cause things to go wrong. If we can do that, I think we should have a satisfying life.
Mm-hmm.
No, we have looked at the laboratory, for example, when space was a problem, a big problem. It's not so much of a problem right now because we can't replace people. And when it was critical, we got moved around quite a bit. That was sort of irritating. But you knew that was going to happen, and probably I did the same thing myself at Barrow in moving projects from here to there. So, you know when it happens to you that's the way it is. What you do is you make this thing work. And in general, it did work. Did we have the ship? We would love to have ship days that we didn't have to go out searching for money, like big chunks of money, $20,000 a day or something like this. Wish that would be different. Might be a little jealous of my colleagues in Japan. I spent a lot of time with the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And there, all those years that I was working with them, they would have a department. And if they knew that they had the use of the ship, they had that ship. That was something they could count on. And they didn't have to worry about where the money came from. That money was allocated to them. They're going to get it. And there were some warts on the system. There's nothing for free.
Mm-hmm.
But they have their problems. They're quite different than ours. But then they started to emulate ours. And education division of the Japanese government cut the national universities loose. They're on their own.
Mm-hmm.
They now depend on alumni. They now depend on companies. So the University of Hokkaido, you know, they were on Toyota's doorstep and Sony's doorstep the very next day when all this happens. That, you know, it takes an awful lot of yen to keep this thing going.
Well, with some of your research funded by oil industry?
Supported by it, yes.
Yeah.
Mainly BC, primarily BC, BP.
BP.
Right.
In
fact, Bill Strever, who is head of their research department, he's affiliate with our school. I made sure that happened.
And is that ever a conflict of interest, that if you're doing scientific research that's funded by industry? Did you ever find that?
It depends. It if it gets controversial, it can be a negative.
Were you ever in that situation?
No. The sort of thing we were doing was to stay out of that arena. We did look at trace metals and organics. They helped with the logistics in some cases, but we had enough non-oil company participation that you can say, hey, the data they come from, BLM sponsored stuff over here, 100% BLM or NSF, giving us the same information that we're getting where BP has come out and helped us with the logistics. Otherwise, we'd never get out here.
Right.
So there's no conflict, whatever, there. If you can find it, you know, show us, but you can't. Mm-hmm. So we stay clear of that. Examples where it could hurt you is with the ozone program. When I was at NSF, I was able to fund, through NSF, a chemist at Oregon. I can't remember, it's not the University of Oregon, it's the Oregon Graduate School. And it's in Portland. Mm-hmm. And they were doing work on ozone. Well, but so had I. So I knew what the situation was in trying to get funding for it. It was tough. Mm-hmm. And but he needed a lot for what he was going to do. So he went to the Chemical Manufacturing Association, which is a big union of concerned industrialists in the chemical industry. They are not going to be very charitable toward an organization that's out to kill their products,
right,
like the Freons and so forth. So he takes the money, and now he's publicizing. And so I put a workshop together in Denver, and he came to the workshop, and here he was 100% on the no problem with ozone folks side of the fence. And you have the scientific community at large pretty much against this, that the evidence was not prima facie evidence yet, but it was getting there that the breakdown of the ozone was due to these freon, fluorocarbons. And then there was by 1993, it was that long since gone from NSF, there was a meeting in Montreal, the Montreal Protocol. You know, that was the end of it for Freons.
Mm.
And so he looked at it as being the end of it for any more support.
Right.
From the chemists, they had lost the battle, but they don't often lose. You find the smoking industry, for example, is a good example.
Right.
You don't find Altria and Philip Morris and those people. Their stock does very, very well. It's still, despite the hammering that they constantly get.
Right.
So from the scientific point of view, my attitude is to sort of stay away from that stuff.
Right.
We have no business doing that. Just the facts.
Being in academia, you can do just the research versus being, you know, paid by industry to be their scientist. Then it's harder to stay neutral. It's easier to be neutral in academia.
It is, and you would be very suspect. Although there are people like Bill Strever at BP and so forth, who I trust him. I personally trust him.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a very good book on environmental science when he was at the University of Louisiana, and he's authored a couple of books here. One is called Cold. Another is called Hot.
Yeah,
they're very good.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them, yeah. Well, I've had you here for a long time, so I was thinking perhaps we should wrap it up here.
Well, it was very nice talking to you.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. I know it's hard to summarize a whole life and career in only a couple hours, but I appreciate it.
I'm sure I forgot things.
That happens. Right, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.